You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
It's time to meet the Muppets, so let's turn on the mic for Muppet Show beginners and experts alike. Come on and join the party that's only just begun. Let's smile for a while, it's time to have some fun.
We're taking in a show tonight. Play the music, light the lights, raise the curtain up.
It's time to meet the Muppets all over again. So take a break and take a load off. Let's all take a ride in a Muppet-tastic time machine with Fergie as your guide. So no more hesitation. Let's start the episode.
We're moving right along. Let's get this show out on the road.
Got the show on the road.
Yo, yo, yeah. What's good? Hello. Welcome to another episode of It's Time to Meet the Muppets, where we recap and deep dive through the Muppet Show in as close to chronological order as possible. I am your host, Fergie L. Philippe, and today we are going to be talking about the one and only Miss Ruth Buzzi, Golden Globe Award-winning and Emmy-nominated actor for her work on the legendary comedy variety show Laugh-In, Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, if you must know the full title. She's also appeared on hit TV shows like The Dean Martin Show, The Love Boat, and, of course, Sesame Street. On Sesame Street, she played the eccentric Ruthie, who was the owner of the store Finders Keepers, which was which was a part of the infamous Around the Corner set, which was a whole thing that happened in Sesame. In the 90s, between seasons 25 and 29, we don't talk about it. It's like Voldemort, like it which must not be named, okay? if you don't remember what the Around the Corner set is, or you're too young to know what that is, Around the Corner was this essentially added part of the set of Sesame Street that included the Furry Arms Hotel, which had some really funny bits and, you know, some really great stuff happening there, and it included some stuff in the neighborhood park. The set eventually got dropped after a few seasons. But, well, hold on. The thing is that Around the Corner is so iconic to me because that is my era of Sesame Street. That is when I grew up around Sesame Street, and Sesame Street was so prevalent with the Around the Corner set, especially the Furry Arms and the park. That is so iconic to me. However, a lot of kids were not able to really keep up with all the plot lines and the new characters that were added, because a lot of new characters ended up being added to that Around the Corner set, especially in the Furry Arms. And so, you know, that entire thing of the Around the Corner set got dropped after a few years. But it lives fondly in my memories. Ruth Buzzi is an incredible comedian who joins a long list of performers who play off the Muppets just brilliantly. But before we get into that, we have a bit of Muppet history. Today, I want to talk about Richard Hunt, another one of the original core members of the Muppet performer troupe that, of course, included, once again, Jim Henson, Frank Oz, Dave Golds, Jerry Nelson, Richard Hunt, Steve Whitmire, and, of course, I'm talking about the main folks from The Muppet Show. Of course, I would never want to forget the iconic people that include Martin Robinson and Fran Brill, Camille Bernara, all of these different people who have worked with The Muppets for quite a Aaron Oscar, Jane Henson herself. There are plenty of people, but when I talk about the main core of performers, I talk about those six guys from the Muppet Show years. But today I want to talk about Richard Hunt. Richard Hunt, who's famously known for playing characters like Scooter, Janice, Beaker, on Sesame Street, of course. He did Two-Headed Monster and Placido Flamingo and Forgetful Jones. But we'll get into all of that. Richard was born in the Bronx, but was actually primarily raised in New Jersey. Richard was actually kind of born into a family of performers or people who were very artistically inclined, and he grew up himself doing puppet shows for local kids in New Jersey. And he was himself, you know, a fan of Jim Henson's creation of Muppets. So much a fan that after high school, Richard famously cold called from a payphone Henson Associates and got in touch with Jim Henson himself. And asked if they were auditioning puppeteers. Funny enough, that very day they were actually auditioning puppeteers. So Richard got himself down and auditioned, which at this same audition, apparently Fran Brill was also auditioning. And from there, they were both hired to be a part of the holiday special, The Great Santa Claus Switch, where they both played Frackles. From there, Richard specifically was hired to perform on numerous television appearances and projects, you know, things like Ed Sullivan's Show and things like that. From there, he was hired full-time on Sesame Street, where he mostly right-handed and in background characters and stuff like that. But over the years, obviously, he grew into more of a main character or main feature performer. He went on to perform in other specials and projects that, of course, included Tamanella Grinderfall in The Frog Prince. He only did the puppeteering while Jerry Jewell supplied the voice. Played Charlie Muskrat in Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, one of the four friends. Whiff in The Land of Gorch, which was the son of King Plubus and his wife, which was that infamous series of sketches on Saturday Night Live. And then he did some background characters and stuff for the pilot presentations of The Muppet Show, which are Muppet Show Sex and Violence, and the Valentine's Day special. He eventually joined the cast of performers in London so that they could shoot The Muppet Show, where he ended up performing the characters of Scooter in the first season, and in the first season frequently swapped with Frank Oz in the role of Miss Piggy, as I've talked about a few times. He eventually also took on the roles of Sweetums and Beaker and Janice and Statler as well. With Janice, though, fun fact, Janice wasn't always performed by Richard, which I think I've mentioned. Janice was originally performed by Aaron Oscar, and she had much more of a voice like this. A little bit more, I want to say film noir. Something very Casablanca. And then eventually she went to, like, kind of a here place, for sure, really. Thank you. I'm here all week. I do impressions nonstop. Richard quickly becomes one of the, you know, company members, like, brightest and most shining personalities. He's known for, you know, his boisterous energy. And also, Richard was just pleasant and hilarious company to be around for, you know, guest stars, and also the creative team and the cast and the crew for Henson Associates. Richard also kind of went on to take on a lot of leadership roles over the years, moving on to direct several, you know, Sesame Street, like, home video specials and an episode of Fraggle Rock. And Richard was a big mentor to a lot of the performers, including one that we're going to be talking to later today, Noel McNeil. At the end of the episode, we'll be putting on a little... Well, it'll either be the end of the episode or be a separate episode, because me and Noel actually ended up talking for quite an amount of time. But Noel was a mentee to Richard Hunt and learned so much from him, and so we get to talk about that a little bit. And he often, you know, looked out for younger puppeteers, especially on the set of Sesame Street, and gave them as much screen time as possible and other things, and he always generously took them to lunch. Richard really quickly became somebody who was a trusted eye and, you know, creative target for many of the projects they worked on. On Sesame Street, like I said before, you know, he went on to becoming one of the, like, more prominent players, doing roles like, you know, Forgetful Jones and Gladys the Cow and Placido Flamingo, like I said. But what's interesting about his work, one of the two-headed monsters with Jerry Nelson, what's interesting about his time on Sesame Street is that, you know, Jim and Frank were often doing all these different things, whether it was Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, you know, Frank was directing Little Shop of Horrors and all of these other films, Bowfinger, you know, well, that was much later, I'm crazy. But, you know, they were doing so many busy things. Jerry and Richard, which I found out from Noel, you know, were traveling back and forth between Toronto and New York to do Sesame Street and Fraggle Rock. And so Jerry and Richard really became these kind of uncles or godfathers, big leadership roles to the younger puppeteers over at Sesame Street. And so Richard's impact on the cast of Sesame Street, especially those who are, you know, there now, like Pam Arciero and David Rudman and Noel and Martin Robinson, you know, there are so many people who really learned under Jerry and Richard, because they were kind of heads of the puppeteers when Jim and Frank were gone. And there's just a lot of love and a lot of wonderful memories associated with kind of that time period around the 80s and, you know, early-ish 90s, which is where we get into this. Richard Hunt actually passed away from HIV/AIDS on January 7th in 1992. Richard's characters that included Scooter, Janice, and one of the two-headed monsters were left to David Rudman, who also performs Cookie Monster and Baby Bear. David Rudman was a close friend of Richard's, and he worked frequently with him. Richard leaves behind a legacy as well, like Jerry Nelson. You know, Richard's legacy is very much of generosity and passion, and it's something that's never talked about enough. I mean, Richard Hunt is truly unbelievably underrated when it comes to the public persona of who the Muppet performers were. Celebrities and stars who worked with the Muppets, you know, people like Rudolph Nureyev and Mark Hamill, have discussed, like, impacts that he's made on them and, you know, close friendships that he's made with them, working with the Muppets, but also kind of in life in general. And, you know, anybody who worked with the Muppets around that era, you know, probably walked away knowing the most about Richard Hunt. Richard Hunt was just such a bright and big personality that it was impossible to forget him. You know, his talent shines through his performance, but so did his enthusiasm for his work for the Henson Company and his life in general. Richard is fondly remembered by friends as a little shit, but in the best way possible. Rest in paradise, Mr. Hunt. We love you. Moving into the actual show. Guys, theme song. Here we go again. Moving into the actual show, y'all. Theme song again. A little change. This one, it's only one word. So, again, y'all, I might be overdoing it or overanalyzing it, but just stay with me, okay? To introduce our guest star, that's what it's time to do. Instead of, to introduce our guest star, that's what I'm here to do. What? Why? I don't understand. Maybe it was an accident. Who knows? I don't know. I'm not even really going to make any opinion on it. It just happened, okay? when Kermit comes out, we hear entrance music, like, and sometimes it's like, ba-da, bum. We've heard that. We'll hear that a few times throughout the show. It's usually not entrance music, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe they do it a few times. I can't remember. But it hasn't happened yet, so this was a fun one for us. Moving into the opening number, Sunny. Oh, we finally, I get to talk about Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem in full. So Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem, what? Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem, resident, I guess, rock band, but they really play it all. They play jazz, they play funk, they play hip-hop, they play, you know, folk. They can play country, like, they do it all, and a few of them are members in the house band as well for the Muppets. But Dr. Teeth is obviously the leader and the keyboard player, based on an artist from New Orleans named Dr. John, who actually just passed away not too long ago. The original, like, core members of Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem are Dr. Teeth on keyboard, Floyd on bass, Janice on guitar, Zoot on saxophone, and Animal on drums, all making up members of the different Muppet performers. So Dr. Teeth played by Jim, Animal played by Frank, Floyd is played by Jerry, Janice is played by Richard, and Zoot is played by Dave Goles. Later on, they add members, the other two members of the Electric Mayhem that are kind of like John Stamos and the Beach Boys, where, like, they come in every now and then, but, like, they're members, but they're not really members, are Lips, who's played by Steve Whitmire, and Clifford, yeah, played by Kevin Clash. And the band is really, I would say, like, the official band of the Muppets. Like, in every movie they show up, they are some of the most consistent musical acts in, one of the most consistent musical acts in the Muppet world, period. Arguably my favorite band on earth. I love Dr. Teeth in the Electric Mayhem, and they were kind of my first things that I fell in love with in terms of the Muppets, especially Animal. Animal was my favorite when I was growing up, and the Electric Mayhem just represent cool and funk, and just they are so unbelievably awesome. So we get to see them really in their element here, but they, of course, there's always a bit. They start the song, which is Sunny by soul R&B artist Sunny Hebb. One of the most recorded songs, or like most covered songs ever, funny enough. But obviously, they're playing the song, and Animal is like, too slow, and they go faster and faster and faster until they all pass out. Great bit, short bit, good bit. It's really wonderful to see how incredibly defined these characters are. Janice is the only one that, consistently, only because of the performer who's playing them, because it was Aaron Oscar, and then it went on to Richard Hunt. But Floyd, Animal, Zoot, and Dr. Teeth are who they were from the first moment they were introduced. Like, these characters, we know exactly who these characters are. We know that they're these crazy, hippie, definitely high band members. And they're so... And I think that's the awesome thing about Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem, is that, like, so much of the joke of the Muppets is that the Muppets are trying so hard to be good, but they're not. they're actually not really successful at the things that they do. But Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem are actually unbelievable. They are an incredible band. They make really good, fun music. It's weird sometimes. It's like, strange music that they make, but can you picture that from the Muppet Movie, or You Can't Take No for an Answer from Muppets Take Manhattan? Even, Living My Nightlife from Great Muppet Caper. I mean, they make such good music. And it is really awesome that, these characters have never really changed. Like, these characters have stayed the same for the past now 50 years. It's really, really incredible. Moving out of the opening number, going into the backstage plot of the show, I love Scooter and Kermit's relationship. I think it's the Gym Neighbors episode, which is that next? I believe that's next. The Gym Neighbors episode, I think, is where we finally get like an introduction of who Scooter is and how he ended up in the theater. But the funny thing about these two, and it's a running joke throughout the whole series, is that Scooter wants to do something. Kermit originally says no. Scooter always is like, yeah, but my uncle who owns the theater would love this. And then Kermit's like, okay, what do you want? immediately. It's such a great joke, and it works every time. And they don't use it too much, but they use it just enough to always make it consistently funny. The backstage plot involves Scooter's uncle, I think, orders a mechanical wind-up host. This is one of the most solid backstage plots of the first season. A mechanical wind-up host, but the host literally just looks like Kermit with a giant, toy twisty thing in its back. Like, it's just a wind-up tool in its back, and it's so weird, it's so strange, and so funny. Jim does such a good job at differentiating, obviously, between the robot and Kermit. But as the show gets, the show continues and the wind-up host becomes a little bit more comfortable, the line between who's Kermit and who's the robot is blurred, and it just becomes really, really great stuff. We move on into At the Dance, which, this is actually one of their more solid rounds. They have a lot of comeback jokes. Comeback jokes are obviously jokes that that come back around. Stand-up comedians will do this all the time. One of my favorites I have to think of is Dave Chappelle's joke about, I met O.J. Simpson four different times, and he goes through the whole show, ends the show having told three of the stories, and then as an encore, he comes back and tells the fourth time. Great comeback joke. And so there's a great series of comeback jokes with the Blue Frackle about his dance skills and his feet. And then at the end, he's like, I told you I have 3 feet. He lifts them up and he falls. Hilarious. Right after At the Dance, there's like a little a scene with Statler and Waldorf about how Statler needs to stretch his legs, and then Animal's like, I'll do it, and then like completely pulls his leg. It's so funny, and it's such a weird little non sequitur, and these kind of little things become a lot more frequent as the show goes on over the years. Statler and Waldorf play this really interesting function in the show where there are a couple times when they come on stage, and there's a plot line in season two where they're in love with one of the guest stars and, want to make sure that they are they are seen and want to try to woo her. But you know, often, you know, Statler and Waldorf don't leave past their their balcony. And there's a lot of sequences that happen up there that are really memorable in the show. And it's a really interesting thing that they do, because they're not scenes, they're not sketches, they are just these guys. They are just these little, like, non sequitur moments that happen throughout the show. So it's really fascinating. We get out of that and we get into the Kermit and Robot dance scene. This routine is reminiscent and basically a direct callback to that classic scene in the Marx Brothers film Duck Soup, where Harpo accidentally breaks the mirror, and when Groucho comes in, Harpo kind of tries to mimic his every move and mirror his every move to confuse him. I've provided a link to the scene below, because the scene is actually, like, really brilliant physical comedy. And obviously this is exactly what happens here. What's really amazing about this scene is that the two performers who are, you know, I'm guessing it's Jim and maybe Frank or something, but the two performers doing the Kermit and Robot dancing, it is brilliantly mirrored, and the technique of, like, matching up all the different movements is done so well that every time I see it, I always forget that it's the wind-up doll, which obviously I'm guessing is the point, but it's really done so well technique-wise. And if you go back in mind to everything that I said about what Muppet technique is, you know, you're doing it, you're performing over your head, you're looking at a monitor, you have to be aware of your spaces. To be able to get it to be that precise in the way that they did takes a lot of skill and effort, and I'm curious about how many times they shot it, how much practice did they have. Like, I just think all of that stuff is so crazy. I'm so fascinated by how they were able to make it happen. Funny enough, they actually kind of do a kind of callback or a tribute to this in Muppets Most Wanted with Kermit and Constantine at the end of the movie. Really funny stuff. We then move into Wayne and Wanda. Something that I noticed pretty immediately is that Sam the Eagle's looks will change quite drastically, and I can't remember quite when it happens. I think it does happen in season 2, but they remove his eyebrows and they remove the bags under his eyes. He looks so unpleasant to be around in the first season, and then the other builds of Sam just make him look very serious. But this Sam is just, he's so annoying and so stiff. But I even think his color gets a bit brighter on his coat, like the actual color of blue that he is. I think they make him a bit brighter. So that'll be an interesting, that'll be a very interesting change for us to notice. Getting into the actual musical number, Wayne and Wanda are singing Row, 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 which is from Ziegfeld Follies of 1912, as written by James V. Monaco and William Jerome. they drown. Hilarious. Funny enough, they do this performance again in the Elkie Summer episode in the third season, and her boat sinks too. In the words of Muppet Wiki, it must be the song. So we get out of Wayne and Wanda, and we go into the news flash, and again, you know, it was about the ocean being held hostage, and they want hugs and kisses from their, I don't know, I might not just get it, but I thought it was long, I thought it was weird. I see what is funny about it, but it does not make me laugh. I'm curious about whether or not I'm just a juvenile, immature, 5-year-old boy at heart. Do I just want to see the newsman get hurt? Which may be very much the case. It could just be, I just want to see him get hurt. But you know, there's like two different types of news flashes. There's like this kind, and then there's some that are like the physical gags that I think they kind of lean more towards, you know, throughout the rest of the season. The rest of the show. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but you know, these kind of longer, more heady jokes when it comes to the newsman, I don't know if these kind of more like wordplay jokes work for him as well as when he gets hurt. Straight up. But, you know, it could just not be my style. But again, this whole thing about figuring out what's going to work and what doesn't, and figuring out like how the character functions and how his material is going to be changed. Because for this, it's not about the newsman character. The newsman character is great, but it's literally about the type of material he's given. When it comes to me figuring out, you know, which news flashes do I enjoy and which news flashes do I straight up not. Yeah, so then we get into Ruth Buzzi's first number, which is Can't Take My Eyes Off of You. I love this number so much. This number is so funny to me for multiple reasons. But Can't Take My Eyes Off of You is obviously a famous song from Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. The introduction, Kermit's so damn cute. That suit is so damn cute. Every time I see it, I'm always like, but Ruth Buzzi and Sweetums are just such what a fantastic pairing. But comedians in general always play off the Muppets well, which, I mean, makes sense. Comedians are actors as well, essentially, but I think what makes comedians great is that there's always a great willingness to be silly. When I think of, like, the Steve Martin episode and the Milton Berle episode, you know, and this episode, there's never any kind of hesitancy to be weird, silly, look stupid, and I think that's what makes this sketch so funny. Ruth Buzzi is such a fool in this. She's also such a brilliant physical performer. I mean, what she is able to, like, get done with her body. She's climbing all over tables and floors and on top of Sweetums and stuff, and you know, she's being thrown around and falling on the floor. It's just so funny. It's such grade-A classic variety show comedy. Just great, great physical humor. I love it. And in addition, speaking of Richard Hunt, you know, Richard in general is underrated, but his performance of Sweetums is never talked about enough. Sweetums is such a complicated full-body character, which Noel will talk about later, but, you know, it's not easy to perform Sweetums because there is a lot happening there at the same time, and it's a big character that really has a lot going on in terms of how to perform the character and in terms of how to accomplish the movement and the lip sync. But Richard is able to give us such a sense of who this character is. And he wasn't the original performer, funny enough. You know, he kind of took it over, but he has such wonderful agility in his performance of Sweetums, and it's really exciting to watch. And I adore watching his Sweetums, and it truly just gets better and better and better and better. I love watching Richard do. I love watching Richard do anything, honestly. But his Sweetums to me is just such. It's such a brilliant example of like how to be a fantastic all around puppeteer. Like the actual manipulation is fantastic, and the characterization is so strong. We move out of Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, and we go into another one of Rolf's song, which is I Never Harmed an Onion, which is a song written by Alan L. Gray, Ginger Joan Gray, and Mo Jaffe. It was made popular by singer-comedian Steve Allen, I believe. You know, when I looked up this song, the most popular version of this is actually Rolf's version from this episode. This song is so funny. It's one of the songs that, as I'm going through the first season, I'm like, oh, I remember this very, very vividly from the first time I watched the first season. There are such horrible puns in it. So funny. Love a good, terrible pun. Rolf is a fantastic comedian. And he works both as, like, a good straight man and as, like, the comedic relief. Like, he can really do it all. And I've said in the past that he's, like, the bar pianist, which I stand by. Like, I do think that he can really be a good grounding sense for all of us. But I also think he is a fantastic comedian. And this song really proves it. And in the sense that, you know, it's just him and he is enough to carry his own in terms of comedy and music. And so, yeah. Rolf is another one of the, like, unsung heroes of the Muppet Troupe. We get out of that musical number and we go into the talk spot, which is, you know, between Ruth and Kermit. A lot of talking about, like, diets and such, and, you know, about body image and stuff like that, like, a little fat phobic, just a little bit. But I guess the only thing that I can think of is that it's astonishing to me how much a part of the culture, and I mean, still is, but I just mean openly, and how, you know, little awareness there was back then about how we speak about diet culture, how we speak about our bodies and just stuff like that. And I'm not trying to preach or make any kind of, statement, but it's just fascinating to be able to see a lot of these shows from the, you know, from the 70s and 80s and kind of make that same. I mean, it's the whole thing about everybody who was angry about all of the content warnings that were going in front of the Muppet Show episodes, which, like, duh, you know, I love the Muppets, but there are some things on the show that's like, oh, that is, you can't say that, you cannot do that, that's offensive. And, you know, people didn't know better, or, you know, what was accepted socially then is not the same thing as what is socially accepted now. And so, for me, at least, and you know, it's possible that I'm coming from a place of privilege when I say this, but it's really interesting to be able to see that and go, wow, you know, I wonder what's behind, you know, because there's so much of what happens in this episode about, you know, fitness and wellness and health, especially when we get into the panel discussion later on that talks about, you know, is the human body obsolete, and talking about yoga and how to stay in shape and stuff. And so it seems like this may be a frequent thing in Ruth Buzzi's comedy, or maybe just what the men who wrote this episode gave to her. I don't know. But again, this is all just very interesting to observe and see with this show and with this segment specifically. You know, again, you know, she's so good at playing off of the Muppets, and her and Kermit are so fun. And I mean, it's so obvious why she ends up going on Sesame Street, because she does a really wonderful job on Sesame Street as Ruthie too. She has this really calming yet eccentric nature that really fits well with the Muppets. take the cheese off my chest. I laughed so hard at that. I could not, I was laughing so hard. I had to pause. It was so funny. Also, something that I hadn't thought about until watching it this time, the laugh track in the show is so well placed. Whoever the sound editor is doing a phenomenal job at setting this laugh track, to the point where I forget it's a laugh track. It often feels like, oh, this feels like a real audience. And maybe it's because, you know, I grew up watching shows like this and watching shows with a lot of laugh tracks, especially on classic sitcoms and stuff. So maybe, you know, maybe it's possible that to the modern viewer, it doesn't sound as authentic, but it sounds very authentic to me. And it really feels, it just feels really well edited in. Yeah. Moving on to Fozzie's comedy monologue. Oh, poor Fozzie. Again, just roasted. Just roasted by Statler and Waldorf. Absolutely. Just completely roasted. Just... poor buddy. Poor Fozzie. That's all I have to say about that. Just poor Fozzie. Moving on, we go to the police sketch, which is... oh, my God. Ruth Buzzi is such a genius comedic actress. This is so funny. Great writing. Really good sketch. I really want to emphasize how good the writing is in this sketch. So, you know, Ruth Buzzi plays somebody who's been captured by the enemy. And they're trying to get her to talk. And then she starts talking. And then they're like, okay, great. And then she can't stop talking. So then the people who captured her are, like, trying to figure out how to get her to shut up. It's just such a great, such a great flip. I'm taking a sketch writing class right now. We're talking about, you know, the different types of sketches or how sketches end. And, you know, you either turn – hold on. I actually have to get my notes out so I can make sure I say this correctly. When it comes to ending sketches, you know, you have a few options in terms of ending the sketch. There are kind of three. One is exhausting the premise. So if the premise is trying to think of a good sketch in terms of exhausting the premise. Target Lady. Target Lady is definitely exhausting the premise on Saturday Night Live. The girl that talks like this! I love Target! You just, you know, put her in situations with people until it's just, like, too much, and then, you know, you exhaust the premise. Then there's flipping the premise, which is exactly what this sketch is, where you have it set up in a certain way where it's, like, where they're trying to get Ruth Buzzi to talk. And then eventually Ruth Buzzi ends up kind of winning by them trying to get her to shut up. And then you have random endings like, you know, pie blows up or a pie blows up. I was trying to say a pie to the face or you get blown up. But honestly, with the Muppets, a pie blowing up is fair. It's accurate. That checks out. That clears. So this is definitely one of those, definitely one of those like flipping the premise, sketches. As far as the ending goes, and it's really well done. It's really short again, but great turnaround. She's a great character in this, and it's just really wonderful. I usually don't go into like all of the backstage stuff, but I want to talk about this one moment because it is so funny and is a testament to Jim Henson's like comedic timing. Miss Piggy goes into the dressing room after talking to Kermit and runs into the mechanical host. When Jim says, or when Kermit the Wind-Up Host says, "Hiya, good looking, where you been my whole life?" There is something about Kermit, or Jim as Kermit, when he is playing kind of the anti-Kermit, you know, something like this, or in Muppets Take Manhattan when he's getting into all of these different costumes and pretending to be these different characters, Jim is able to tap into something so authentically funny. And part of it's because he has done such a brilliant job at establishing who Kermit is. Kermit, you know, when Kermit ends up turning into some kind of weird comedic relief, it's because we have really well established who Kermit is outside of that so well. Kermit is the straight man. Kermit is, like, the one we look to for sanity. Kermit is kind of the one that we hang on to when it comes to how much reality we're willing to depend on for this world of Muppets. And when it flips, when it turns, whether that's, you know, something like this or whether Kermit loses his cool, it becomes so unbelievably funny. And a moment like this is a perfect example of that. Baby Figs, always funny. Baby Figs is brought up, again, I think in an Andy Williams episode where he's like, we'll hear the pitter patter of tiny figs, referring to frog pig, hybrid. Also, there is an entire page on Muppet Wiki dedicated to the offspring of Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy. I found it disturbing. Maybe you'll enjoy it. I'm not providing a link. I hated it, but, you know, just so that you know it exists. But this is one of those really, really, really great moments. And then eventually Kermit comes back in and, you know, Piggy karate chops. It's a whole funny. It's a great, great bit that happens. There's a lot of great non sequitur backstage moments that happen in this episode that I think over the years they realized that that's where so much of the good stuff is with the Muppets. It's not when they're performing, it's their relationships to each other, which I feel like I've heard Frank Oz say, where, you know, the comedy behind the Muppets or the thing that connects the Muppets are their relationships to each other and how much they love each other / how much they hate each other. And this sketch is kind of, you know, or this sequence is kind of where that really proves that. You know, there's another moment I'm thinking of. I think it's the Andy Williams episode where, you know, Piggy is planting a rumor that her and Kermit are getting married, and everyone backstage finds out. And there's a really great and a pretty famous scene when Floyd's like, "Hey, Kermit, me and the band gonna play at the wedding," and Kermit's like, "What wedding?" Floyd goes, Well, I just heard the news that you and Miss Fatback was going to tie the knot and raise chitlins. And there's a whole fight, you know, between Kermit and Piggy. But those backstage scenes are so funny, and they're so important to the building of the characters. And I think that that's where a lot of the character development comes from, more than any of the performances or the musical numbers or anything like that, which is probably really obvious. But just to emphasize once more. We get out of that backstage moment and we go into the house sketch, which I don't think we've actually covered. So, this sketch, there are a series of sketches called Talking Houses, and they were only during the first season. There were only about 7 of these, and there were these 4, you know, supposed to be, you know, reminiscent of like life-size houses, and 2 of them were played by John Lovelady and Jerry Nelson, which most of the sketches were those two, but the last sketch they ever filmed was the only one spoken by the 3rd and the 4th house, and those were performed by Frank Oz and Aaron Oscar. These sketches were really, really funny. They were one-liners. In this episode, you know, the 2nd house says, "I hear your son, the hotel, has become interested in his religion." The 2nd house says, "I hear your son, the hotel, has become interested in his religion." And the 1st house says, "Oh, interested isn't the word. He's seriously thinking about becoming a monastery." These are great jokes about building infrastructures or houses, and they're so terrible, but so funny. They didn't last long. The puppets were kind of weird. The sketches were funny, but I can see why they took him out, because it kind of does interrupt the flow of the show, and the houses don't necessarily fit in with kind of the rest of the Muppet look, but they do, you know, almost all of them are so great, but they're some weird sketches, man. It's just weird to see a bunch of talking houses, but it's really funny stuff, but that's what we got here. We then get into Can't Roller Skate in a Buffalo Herd, which is written by, famously, Roger Miller. They end up performing the song again when Roger Miller comes to guest star. I love the jug bands on the show, and there have been different iterations or different types of, like, country acts. The jug band in this is called the Go-Go La La Jubilee Jug Band. They're eventually replaced in the 2nd season with Lubbock Lou and his Jug Huggers. They're probably a little bit more recognizable. There's actually not really any reason known why, from a creative standpoint, why they ended up changing these characters. Probably just to, like, get a more solidified and kind of polished set of puppets. However, according to the Muppet Encyclopedia, as written by Craig Sheman, the band themselves claim that their split was due to a fight over whether or not they should put a hole in the wash tub. And that's all I will say on the matter. Very controversial subject. Moving out of the Can't Roller Skate in a Buffalo Herd number, and going into the final sketch of the evening, which is the panel discussion, which I was mentioning earlier, which was about, is the human body obsolete? Really good balance of all these different characters. I think Ruth Buzzy's character is so funny, and the idea of Sam the Eagle being in love with her is so great as well. Kermit trying to, you know, obviously make it, trying to settle things. Really, really turned on pigs, like really sexual pigs. Nasty. But hey, listen, go off, I guess. This is such a chaotic panel discussion and doesn't really go anywhere. Like, Ruth starts doing yoga in the middle of it, and Sam can't stop watching. The pigs are quite literally mounting each other. They're a lot shorter than the one that we talk about in the Rena Moreno episode, which is interesting because this one is before, in terms of filming it, they filmed this one before they filmed Rita Moreno. But this is a really successful sketch, so maybe they wanted to just play with form a little bit longer for that one. A really funny sketch. Interesting because they usually end the shows with a musical number, and I even think before Can't Roller Skate in the Buffalo Herd, they mentioned that it's the final number, but then they have this sketch. So that's just really interesting, but it is really funny, so I could see why they decided to end it with this. But with that comes to the end of this episode, or comes to the end of the episode of Ruth Buzzy. I'm going to go ahead and just tag on my conversation with Noel that I got to have earlier today. Noel McNeil is just such a wonderful human being, fantastic puppeteer. I love him dearly, and I'm so glad that he came on and decided to talk to us a little bit about his experience of working with Jim Frank, specifically Richard and Jerry, and even gets to talk to us a little bit about, you know, performing Sweetums. I really wanted to talk about the mechanics of performing Sweetums so that you all can hear, like, the difficulty that it takes to perform that character and why Richard's performance is so fantastic. So, yeah. Enjoy Noel McNeil.
Recording?
Yeah, I know. I was like,
this is gold, man. Don't waste time. Oh, I'm a blatherer from old school. You should just like
as soon as you see me, just
enter the room. Hit record.
Hit record.
Just gonna start doing these stupid stories. So go for it.
They are not stupid. They're fantastic. All righty. Hey everybody, we have with us today a puppeteer, writer, director who has worked on numerous programs like Sesame Street, Puzzle Place, Eureka's Castle, Ubi, Between the Lions, Great Space Coaster, Julie's Green Room, and you most likely know him as the titular character in the Henson Playhouse Disney program, Bear in the Big Blue House. We have Noel McNeil. Noel, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us a little bit today.
Of course. Hello, everybody out there. Hope everybody is safe and well vaccinated.
Yes.
I know I am.
Yes, I am as well. I hope we all go get vaccinated so that we can go back to life, to be in the after.
Exactly. In the after.
Yes. In the after. Thank you so much for joining us today so we can talk a little bit about Sweetums. Before we specifically get into that, you know, you, which we've talked about before, you have a unique pleasure of being part of like a small group of puppeteers today who are still working that had the opportunity to work with Jim Henson and Frank Oz and Jerry Nelson and Richard Hunt. So can you talk to me a little bit actually about what it was like working with Richard and, you know, what that experience was like?
Richard was great. He was wonderful. He was so warm. He was so giving and the most sarcastic SOB you ever would encounter. First time I worked with Richard, I was actually a wrangler before I was a puppeteer, and I was the wrangler on Sesame Street, the person who takes care of the puppets. And so Richard was like always like sarcastic with these little like snide comments. And then one day, like he's on the floor next to Jerry. They're doing a bit and the bit's done. And I go over to take the puppet from Richard and he has like his like a New York Times crossword and like all that. He sees me coming and just throws it at me and goes back to the puzzle. And I just glare at him and I slowly turn and walk away. And as I turn, he yells, "Hey," and I turn back and he says, "If I didn't like you, I'd be nice to you." And I walked over and I leaned down and I said to him, "Well, Richard, you must effing love me." And that's when he laughed, but Richard had like this really genuine laugh that he would do.
Uh-huh.
And he really laughed at that. And after that, we were fine.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
Totally understood each other. So it was great. And the one thing about Richard was like, whenever a kid came to visit and he happened to be there, even if he wasn't doing anything, he would like go over to the Muppet box where all the puppets were kept and take like an Anything Muppet or like he had this character, Placido Flamingo, or any character. And just put it on and then just go entertain the kids. There was the 25th anniversary, because that's how far back I go. And there was this huge group scene in the middle of the street.
Uh-huh.
And had all these kids. And we had to, like, stop the song or for some reason for, like, a lighting adjustment or something. And so rather than break everybody, they just, like, kept everybody exactly where they were, including kids. And that's when Richard stood up and just started entertaining the kids with the puppet and just did like this little impromptu sing along just to keep the spirits up, just to keep the kids entertained rather than get them bored. And that was him.
Yeah.
Cause he would do like little puppet shows out in like New Jersey where he was growing up. So I was like,
right.
And he also, was one of the stars of the very short lived series, Little Muppet Monsters.
That's right. Yeah.
He also got to direct a couple of episodes. So it was like really cool. So yeah. Richard knew exactly what he was doing. And so he was great. He was wonderful. And so,
you definitely get that sense from him for sure, that he really knew what he was doing. And I talked about this before, but Richard's, you know, obviously the original, I don't know what to call, you know, the nine old men from Disney. I don't know what to call the original six guys. I don't know whether we can call them the six old men or whatever they are.
I don't know. I don't know what you would call, like, you know, the original Muppet guys.
The original Muppet guys, right. But you know, they're all obviously very strong, but Richard's sense of performance is one of the ones that always sticks out, and I'm sure many people have said that, but it really was one of those things where it's like he understood the essence and the spirit of what everything that he performed in so well, just intrinsically, not even from an analytical point of view, it seems like.
Oh yeah, he was very underrated and didn't get like the true credit or recognition that he deserved. The way Jim and Frank had that magic chemistry, Richard and Jerry Nelson had the same chemistry. And so that's why Janice and Floyd worked so well. That's why Griff and Sully on Sesame worked so well, because they had that kind of chemistry. The two-headed monster was Richard and Jerry. And that's why
they
worked so well, because they had that kind of chemistry and they had that kind of friendship. And also, you know, up in Fraggle Rock, like the way that, you know, Junior Gorg and Dad got along. So
right.
Well, it was because of Richard and Jerry. So. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, I know that it was said a lot that, you know, Jim and Frank were usually gone a lot of the time because they were off doing their own other projects. And so when it was full time on Sesame Street, when you guys were recording 100 episodes a year, maybe even more than that.
The glory days. Yes. the 80s. Yes.
Yeah. Before laws.
Yeah. Like,
but it was often said that, you know, Jerry and Richard are kind of like almost the godfathers or the uncles of Sesame Street, because they were the ones that were there kind of full time. And that period is often referred to as like the golden age of Sesame. What was kind of the, you know, maybe teaching relationship between Richard and the other younger puppeteers during that era?
Richard and Jerry would shuttle, because they would shuttle back and forth between Sesame and Fraggle Rock. That was being done. So they were doing like double duty. So going back and forth. So from what I heard from like the Fraggle Rock puppeteers, Richard was also like very, you know, giving and very generous in terms of giving people a chance to like do characters and all that. So it was the same thing on Sesame, and particularly on Little Muppet Monsters, because like myself and like Cheryl Blaylock, Jim Krupa, and the other background puppeteers, he would cast us in these like extra roles, but that had lines just to give us a chance to have like more to do than like a right hand here or you know, generic, you know, chicken in the back. So he was very good. And just like, he knew exactly in terms of like, pacing and staging, like how the puppets like should look. And so he was very generous with the time on screen. So he was, of all the people I've met, like Richard was definitely one of the people who was not a diva in any sense of the word at
so
all.
Funny. Yeah.
Now, I have met divas, but that's a whole other podcast.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. When we get to the real Muppet podcast.
Exactly.
After hours.
Exactly. If you want Fergie's Muppet Tea, that's a whole other podcast, but we'll keep it nice and like light and just like Richard was definitely like Richard and Jerry too. Jerry was wonderful. Jerry and Jan came to my wedding. So, which is great. It's like they RSVP'd and, when Susan Elia McNeil, the author of the Maggie Hope Mysteries, available on Amazon.
By now.
she looked and she just squealed like, oh my God, the Count is coming to my wedding. It was great. Yeah. So it was just like, it was great. And Fran too. Fran is also one of like the original, Muppet performers of Sesame that I got to know. And she too came to my wedding.
Oh,
very classy. She was the first one to RSVP, the first one to send a wedding present, like, and handwritten thank you notes. I mean, like Fran is old school.
like old school etiquette. Classy.
Oh yeah. You very can see old that. School. Oh yeah, definitely. So it was great. So having worked with her and Richard and Jerry and getting to know Jim and Frank, I was always like so like thrilled every time Jim and Frank saw me and they remembered my name. They just like, you know,
yeah.
It's like, hello, Noel. So I was like, I know. I'm just like, it's like, hey guys. And in my inside, I'm just like squealing like a little girl. Oh my God, you remember who I am? Oh my God.
those impressions were so perfect of right. both of them.
Yeah, exactly. And Richard was on Follow That Bird. And so
right.
that was the summer. We were up in Canada for like 3 months. Uh-huh. And Richard did all the count stuff. So whenever the count was on, it was uh-huh. Richard doing it, and then Jerry dubbed over it later on.
Oh, interesting.
So he was doing all that stuff.
Wow.
Which was really fun. And then, just a side note, Follow That Bird, there was the scene with Ernie and Bert in the biplane. It's the only time uh-huh. and it's like, Jim and Frank were together on the movie.
Okay.
And so it's like, and they're doing the song Upside Down. Uh-huh. And it's one of those things, looking back now, it's just like, why didn't you all use green screen or blue screen? No, let's have the two most prominent puppeteers on Earth, like, suspended 12 feet in the air. And laying on a platform with their arms going through to manipulate these characters actually upside down. It's like,
wow.
Was this the best idea to really do this? Really?
Why be practical when you
exactly?
Can
be... It's like I don't know, maybe it's a Canadian thing. I don't know. This is like, well, it was like, all right, let's have these guys hanging upside down. But it's like, okay, but
oh,
yeah,
that's
like
so
Richard,
funny.
Richard was Richard, Jim, Jerry, Frank, Fran, Carol. It's just like mm-hmm. they were like, yeah, they were the originals, and
yeah.
it's like it's amazing. And having learned from them and. And it's like, let me tell you, kids, like, you've got these little online courses and you can just go and you can just like do your references on YouTube and the uh-huh. Google and all that. It's like in my day, I had to stand there and watch these
watch.
Guys and actually try it with them
oh
and
my
what
gosh.
Would work and what wouldn't. So, yeah.
Oh, could you actually tell me, can you tell the story that you told me about, when right handing and how Richard kind of taught you the trick of looping around the
oh,
belt.
Oh yeah. It's like, there's this, you can go to YouTube and there's the classic song from the count, the Batty Bat. And yes. I got to right hand for Jerry and we actually had to like, you know, waltz around like, you know, the table inside the count's castle, which is actually a set raised like 5 feet off the floor. So this way we're standing up comfortably. And so, Richard gave me this tip of taking my thumb and looping it through the back of Jerry's belt loop. Mm-hmm. And so my right hand is up in the air. And so my left hand is like looped this way, literally just to like hang on.
Right.
And so that's what I was doing. So then we did it. So because it's and when it's time to do it, we're just like very close together. I'm just like hanging on and we're like, twirling around and twirling around and twirling
right.
around and stopping. And it's like, it's great. We did it like, I think we did it like twice. We rehearsed it and then we did it twice. And like, that was it because
wow.
with Sesame, it was like, it's very quick. It's like,
yeah.
it's because of the fact that there was so much to do on the schedule. And also that was doing, what was called the inserts, the Muppet inserts.
Oh,
and
okay.
so
right.
that was separate from the street stuff. And so when I was up, it's like you had to keep things moving. And so, yeah, it was great. And then I got to right hand for Richard a lot for Forgetful Jones. And
okay.
classic bit with Forgetful. It's called Eklahoma. And it's on, again, YouTube.
I was just talking about this sketch in one of my writing classes.
Yes. And it's I use this sketch as a reference for when I'm teaching monitor puppetry. For so many references, for like the fact that, you know, you're in this bit and you're not the star of the bit, but you're a puppet in this bit and you have to stay up. So the cows and the horses have to stay up. They can't just like drop out because they're tired. Like, no,
right.
you have to stay up. You have to keep it alive. And there's this little choreography. And then there's like the pacing of of the bit. And it's like, it's not rushed. It's like just taking your time. Yeah. And just like really enjoying it. And then also the pacing and also the emotional buildup of Kermit, which was Jim. And just how Kermit very gradually just gets angrier and angrier, more frustrated. Not angry, just frustrated.
With
forgetful,
yeah.
Forgetting it. He starts up with Oklahoma. It's like, no, it's Oklahoma. It's just like, it's like Oklahoma. It's like, no, it's O. And finally, you know, and forgetful does like Oklahoma. And that's when Kermit comes in and just completely loses it. And it's just like, he didn't do this in the very beginning. It's a build. And then the way Jim does lose it with Kermit, it's very controlled. I mean, yes. Kermit is just absolutely losing it, but it's very controlled. It's not flailing the puppet around. It's very controlled and very focused and very precise. Mm-hmm. And it's great. And we did the bit twice and like, that was
it.
And there's like 4, 6, 7, 8. 9, like 10, I think there's like 10 of us like doing this. And what's great is like Jerry is he's the haystack in the back because that's the gag at the end. So basically he's sitting there with his little Times crossword puzzle because Jerry would do the Times crossword. But then he's also the voice when Kermit goes like and roll sound and you hear spade. And that's Jerry. Spade. Every time. It is great.
That's fantastic.
Until finally at the end when it's like his big moment, the haystack turns around, the horse says like, hope they're not having like, you know, hay for lunch. And the haystack turns around and says, you hope they're not having hay, and like waddles off. And like, that's the gag. And like, that's it. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
It's great. So it's like one of those bits, one of the many bits I got to be in with them. Jim and Jerry and Richard. So,
and it's so interesting how you're discussing, you know, and it's so true what you're saying, like how now in this golden age of social media and the internet, you know, we have hundreds and hundreds of hours of references. I watch Sesame Street every night and just being like, I have access to all of this footage. And, you know, when you were coming up, it was really just a matter of watching and being thrown into the fire. And, you know, I think now because they're on a bit of a shorter schedule, they have a little bit more liberty and freedom to shoot maybe more than just twice before they have to move on to something. But when you were there, you know, you really had twice to get it right, or twice to get it right enough and then, you know, move on to the next thing. And so that's such a different way of learning that has obviously its own benefits considering what you've done. But like, you know, I can only imagine the mental game that you have to do with yourself to not only have to like get it right, but it's also like, I'm working with Jim and Frank and Richard and Jerry. I'm not trying to mess this up. I'm trying to get this right so they can do their job.
Oh yeah, exactly. So it's like you have to like, you know, be on your game, be professional and just like come prepared. And like, if you're assisting them or if you're a background character, just to like, you know, make sure like you don't screw up because their time, especially at that point, like Jim, because Jim was just like doing so many things. So when he came in to do his stuff, it's like, it really, like, there was like, sometimes it would just be like one day when Jim was available and like, that's it.
You have to film all of his stuff.
Right.
Oh,
like the Ernie and Bert's or like the Ernie stuff or Kermit or, So it's just like all that stuff had to be done. And then Jim was all, there's the book. Jim Henson is like the biography written by Brian Jones. And I've read it. And it's a great book. If any of you haven't read it, you know, read it. And for me, it was interesting because to read Jim's life, you know, like the early years and all that. And then from like 1982 on, that's when I was part of Sesame Street and that's when I got to know Jim. Uh-huh. And so it was really interesting, like seeing that and realizing like how short of amount of time was left.
I think about that all the time.
He died and not knowing it and just reading like all the stuff that he was involved in and doing and all this stuff. And so for me, it was just like, wow, it's like that time was really like precious. And so I really treasure looking back now, like those times, those moments I actually got to like work with Jim and talk with Jim. I was actually right handing for him for Ernie for a bit and they had to like adjust the light. And so the Wrangler came over and said, you know, going to take Ernie, and Jim was like, no. I was like, we're good. And I was thinking, we are. Oh, okay. I'm still got my hand inside Ernie. So we just, the two Apple boxes, the wooden boxes.
Uh-huh.
And just, we just like Jim started to sit down. So of course I have to sit down too. And in the millisecond this is happening, I'm thinking just like, oh my God, I'm sitting next to Jim Henson. I should say something, like start something. It's like conversations, like anyone would give their right arm to be here. So if you give your right arm, you couldn't be your right hand. Focus, no, focus. Focus, say something. And then I remember what my mom said, because I figured it's like, I can't, it's like asking about puppetry and care. It's like, it would be so like, how many times does he have to answer these questions? So then my mom, I remember, she said, if you ever want somebody to talk about, like something to talk about with them, ask them about their kids. And Jim had five kids.
Right.
So I asked Jim, Jim, how are the kids? And he's like, oh, thanks for asking. And he just started telling me like what Brian was doing, what Cheryl was doing, what Heather was doing, what John was doing. And it's like,
yeah.
And so it was just like, just asking what Lisa was doing, like asking the kids. And it was great. And then that filled the time. And then we started to do the bit again. So it was like, yeah, it was great.
That's lovely. Oh, yeah. That's awesome. Wow. Wow. departing from the actual performers themselves, but getting into the performances, we've already talked a lot about, you know, Richard's generous spirit, but I think that also transferred to his performance as well. He really obviously had a very jovial, big, bright, you know, personality when it came to his performance. And
oh, yeah.
I talk about it in the episode, but Sweetum specifically, you know, if we're going to talk about underrated performances, I think his performance as Sweetums is really something that is a marvel. And I think about all the time, I just think it's such a well articulated performance. But before we get into the specifics of that, can you actually explain the Big Bird rig of the full body puppet? And that was the same rig for Bear as well, right?
Yeah, Bear and Big Bird had a similar rig, which is different from Sweetum. Sweetum is not done that way.
Exactly.
But for Big Bird and Bear is basically I and Carol, we would have monitors strapped to our chests.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be a microphone like right up on top. So this way you're looking down at the monitor and your right arm is up through the character's neck into the character's head. And Bird and Bear had these little triggers. We would just like, for me, I would have my little trigger on for my index finger. Carol would have it for his pinky. And then our left arms would be in the character's left arm or wing. And there'd be this tiny little piece of string going from the left arm up through a little ring under the chin and then down to the right arm. And it would be stuff. So this way, no matter what the left arm did, the right one would move up and down. So it was like cantilevered.
Right.
And so, yeah. The advantage of Bear is that with Bear, he was kind of like, you know, a bear that's kind of standing up. So he always had this kind of like hunched over kind of look. So there was more room to play with going up and down. With Big Bird, you got to keep your arm up straight the whole time.
Yeah, right.
So it's a little bit harder to be Bird, but you get used to it. It's like, it's like Carol taught me this trick of like, you know, when he would get tired sometimes, when he would do appearances like on stage, you know, Big Bird would notice something on the floor and like look down between his legs, which is really funny. But it's also a way of getting the blood back to your hand.
Back to your hand. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And then he would notice something way up high and like have Big Bird look way up. And so just to get the arm moving again.
Right.
And so I've done that with Bear too. So Bear would have this range of motion where he would like look up and look down, also like with the dancing and all. So, but with Sweetums is different. Sweetums, basically you wear his clothes, his body. It's like, it just like hangs on you. And then the head is attached to this, has like this helmet inside, like literally like a football helmet that you just chin strap to you. And there's this handle and it's the original like handle. Like they just refurbished like the original head. There's a spare head, but there's like the original head. And there's this handle that's literally a dresser drawer handle that you just hold on to and you just pump up and down, like really, really exaggerated. And then you can let go. And then it's the trick that Richard did so well, of like you could put your then right arm into Sweetums's right arm and have both arms going, and then like grab the hand and then pull out so that you can go back in
go
and
back
then to wow. doing the hand the head. Or if it's like for the Hollywood Bowl or the O2, I would like it, like running out in front, just jerk the head around to look like he's saying something so that you could have both hands while you're running. So it just like looked better. So,
right.
Yeah. Cause we was doing the, Bohemian Rhapsody, and there's a part where, Sweetums was supposed to chase Bobby Moynihan like across the stage. And I suggested, it's like, what if we went out into the audience and like ran across the audience?
Oh my gosh.
And they were like, are you sure? Cause of course, Noel suggested this while LA's going through a massive heat wave. So it's like, right. You know, during rehearsal, it's like, you know, 100 degrees outside in the sunshine. And then that night, you know, it cooled off to a balmy 85. So, but let's do this, Noel. Brilliant idea. Yeah. So, but it worked. It was great. So, and I remember those like tricks that, I heard that, Richard did. So, and it was, and it's great. Like the fact that I've been Sweetums. John Henson's been Sweetums. Now Matt does Sweetums. So we're like this part of this legacy that Richard started. Mm-hmm. And, but Richard wasn't the original Sweetums because there's a special, the Frog Prince, and he wasn't the original Sweetums. So it's very interesting. It's like,
yeah,
who the original Sweetums was. I can't remember his name offhand. And that was also back when Sweetums' eyes would actually glow. And so he was more like a villain. He was more like a monster. But then.
Yeah, a true ogre.
Yeah, but then for the Muppet Show, he kind of like, he was like rough around the edges. And there's this great bit. I forget which show it is, but it's with Richard and Robin. So it's Jerry and Richard. Mm-hmm. And it's with Sweetums and Robin. And it's called Two Lost Souls from the show Damn Yankees.
Yeah.
And it's so cute. With this throne chair and Robin's on the back of the throne chair, and Sweetums is sitting in front and they're singing it together. And it's like one of the cutest bits between this huge hulking monster and this cute little frog.
Right.
He's just adorable. Gotta love Robin. Robin was awesome. So cute.
Robin was the cutest. Robin is the best. Love Robin. Oh my gosh. So with Sweetums, as you were just saying, you know, because the rig is set up differently, there's not a monitor inside of Sweetums. So when it comes to being able to see out, how do you see out?
you see out the mouth, because the mouth is hanging on these elastics.
Uh-huh.
So this way, when you pull down, they can snap back up. But when you let go, it's still kind of like open slightly. So it's kind of like this gaping. So you have enough so that you can see out of, but then you have to, you know, adjust. So, cause the fact that the eyes are actually, you know, a foot above your head. So if Sweetums was looking down at somebody, so like for the O2 and then for the, and for the Hollywood Bowl, when Sweetums has this moment with Kermit, I have to go and then I have to like make it look like Sweetums is looking at Kermit. And so tilting the head. So that, and the eyes are also remote control, so that tilting the head so that the eyes shift down at an angle so it looks like they're looking at Kermit. So instead of looking at Kermit through the mouth, I have to kind of like look at like Matt's foot. But then it looks like Sweetums is actually looking at Kermit. And so
Kermit. Yeah. Right.
And then same thing with at the ending, just like having it slightly, like looking slightly down so that this way it looks like he's looking straight out into the audience, but then he can look up and look down and so it was like very, very broad.
Yeah, very broad. And especially because you as far as I know, you've only done Sweetums for the stage shows. You haven't performed them on film, have you?
Oh, I have.
You have?
I did. I got to do his voice for Muppets Letters to Santa.
Here
in Brooklyn. And with Jane Krakowski and I forget the guy from Law and Order.
Jesse Martin.
Yeah, Jesse Martin, yes. And so so I got to be actually do Sweetums' voice for that song, The Letters to Santa, and then when the Muppets come in to the apartment at the end. So got to do his voice. So
yeah.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, great. So then was there a giant difference in terms of performing him for the Letters to Santa special versus doing it on stage in terms of like exaggerated movements or things like that? Or was it really roughly the same?
No, it was really roughly the same, except now I had to I had an earpiece because I had to listen to Matt's playback because he does the voice now. And so I had to listen to the playback and then lip sync to it. So.
Oh, yes. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I had to listen back. So So it was like, and just like the timing of it and whatnot. So.
And that happens so often that you guys often, whether it's, you know, when Matt was doing it for Jerry in his last years or when somebody's on the same scene with another performer, having to catch the other performer's vocal track. What are some of the things that you kind of have to keep in mind with that?
Like the timing of the voice. It's kind of like you listen to the track enough times so that you know there's like a rhythm to the line. And so that's when you can like really like anticipate like how it's going to be. It's harder if it's live. So you have to like kind of like enough rehearsal, you kind of get the essence of like what the rhythm is. Mm. So it's not so pre-recording it's more consistent. But even if it's still live, there's still like a certain consistency because it's in character. So you kind of guess like what it will sound like and then how to finesse it. And so you have to like also anticipate like when to open the mouth and when to stop.
Right.
Right. So there are ways of like cheating it a little bit. So, so it looks flawless.
So that you don't know.
Yes. You don't know at home. We know, but you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, no, thank you so much for kind of coming by and just talking a little bit about your experience with Sweetums and your experience with the guys and just in general. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Before we go, I'd love for you to promote Noel's Book Nook. Just talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. My podcast is called Noel's Book Nook. It's available on Google and Apple and Spotify and Anchor. And it's basically me reading chapters and sometimes stories from like Beatrix Potter and Robert Louis Stevenson and Lewis Carroll. And I started it last year because of, you know, I was home.
Right.
As we all were. And it was like, what should I do today? And I thought I would just like try a podcast where I'm just like reading stories. And when I do read, I do have a certain tone in my voice that's reminiscent of a certain Bruin who owned a home. So it's kind of comforting for some people to hear this. So yeah. And I'm going to be, doing a new season this year. So I'm going to start recording and it'll be coming out later, this summer, with the help of my friend Nate Beagle at Beagle Beat Studios. So if you have any audio or editing, or if you want to get into voiceovers, go to natebeagle.com because Nate is the man.
Nate is the man.
Work. Right. And he also is the voice of, and the puppeteer for Crow, for Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yes, he is. That's
and they
right.
They just are going to be having a brand new season of shows. So.
Oh, fantastic. So, yeah, make sure you guys look out for that. And make sure you look out for Noel's Book Nook. Noel, thank you so much again for stopping by. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Stay safe, everybody.
And there you have it. A fantastic conversation with Noel McNeil, who I love talking to all the time. That comes to the end of our episode. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. If you like the show, can you do me a solid and subscribe/follow the podcast at Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts? Please also follow us on Instagram at Meet the Muppets Pod, which is at MeetTheMuppetsPod. And of course, you can follow my personal account on Insta, Twitter, and TikTok at Fergsters95. That's at Fergsters95. If you're looking for some more Muppetational fun, please head over to Muppet Wiki, Tough Pigs, or the Muppet History Twitter account, which also now has its own podcast. Please listen to the Muppet History podcast. It's really wonderful. More podcasts about puppetry themselves, specifically the Jim Henson style of puppetry. Head over to Below the Frame by Matt Vogel, Under the Puppet by Grant Pachoco, Getting Felt Up by Nate Beagle and Dan Eli Becker, and of course Puppeteers, which I just appeared on not too long ago, about a couple weeks ago. Check out my episode and check out Puppeteers in general, which is by Cam Garrity and Adam Krutinger. Are you looking for more pop culture, Disney theme park links and stuff like that? Make sure you're listening to the DJ Bob Show, Defunct Land, Yesterworld, Theme Park History, and Disney Dan from Getting Felt Up, all on YouTube. For more info on the podcast itself, please head to bpn.fm/Muppets if you want to know more about me, and just to know about the podcasts that are featured on Broadway Podcast Network, which we are a proud member of, just head to bpn.fm. This has been It's Time to Meet the Muppets. I am your host, Fergie L. Philippe. I will see you all next time. Bye!
We're moving right along. Let's get this show out on the road.
Got the show on the road.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at SuppsMusical.com.